do that math and not go, oh yeah, it's 200,000 in discretionary earnings. You got to go, okay, it's 200,000. And what percentage is that of my total revenue? And how do I improve that? And then you drill down to those expenses.
Welcome to the Quiet Light Podcast with Joe Valley and Mark Doust. Since 2007, Quiet Light Brokerage has been helping thousands of online entrepreneurs realize their dream of buying and selling online businesses. And now, we're bringing all the knowledge our team has acquired straight to you. No matter your niche or industry, these lessons, tips, and strategies will help you build, grow, acquire, or sell your online businesses better. And now, here's Joe and Mark.
All right, Joe, you probably know this from your experience here at Quiet Light Brokerage, but how long does it take you when you're talking to a client for the first time or somebody who is requesting a value of the business? How long on average do you think it really takes you to be able to get an estimate of the size of their business and the value of their business?
Yeah, there's really no short answer to that. I feel like you want me to tell you 5 minutes, but the answer is at least an initial call, you get a ballpark range. And then you got to look at the financials and look at the trends, year over year trends, and look at the details of the financials. It's so much of that answer and the time frame around it depends upon how good their documentation is and how much they know about their own books.
Sure. And just so you know, I want you to answer whatever you want to answer. I'm not going to feed you answers. Answer the truth. Yeah, well, I think that's true, right? We've been looking at businesses for a while. We've looked at a lot of businesses in the roles that we have. And so I thought it would be good for us to have a discussion today to talk about some of the things that we look at in a business's financials to really be able to determine its value pretty quickly. What are some of the things that you, with your expert eye, you know, from all the deals that you've done, what do you look at when you look at a company's financials? You know, I know every buyer out there listening to this, you probably have the reports that you look at. We have the advantage of working with lots of different buyers. We see the different approaches that different buyers have made. And I know that over the last 10 years, I've expanded and changed what I look at and probably look at more things and things maybe wouldn't concern me as much directly, but I'm looking at to try and anticipate what buyers would want to see.
So what's the number one thing you look at first? You're always looking at this one thing. What is it?
By the way, if anyone's wondering, no, we don't have a guest. So you have to live with Joe and I for the rest of this episode, but we'll try and make it entertaining. Okay. So what do I look at first and foremost? I have gotten very addicted to looking at trends. Trends to me tend to be the most important thing with somebody's financials outside of whether or not they're clean, of course, right? They've got to be clean if we're going to be able to make any real evaluation.
Can we define clean? What do you mean by that?
Oh, that's a good question, actually.
Somebody define in the audience clean was just asking it. They just piped through to my head.
You're anticipating what people are going to be asking weeks from now. I love it. What are clean financials? So clean would be separated from other businesses. And that doesn't mean that you have to have completely separate tax IDs. That's ideal, you know, separate tax IDs and separate books. I would love it if that's what you had. But at least within QuickBooks or Xero or whatever you're using, some way of identifying this is for this business. This expense goes for this business and that expense goes for another business if you have multiple businesses running. Also, actually having that tracked clearly so that you're not just taking estimates on things. Finally, not mixing in a lot of personal expenses into it. In the episode that I recorded with Brian, we talked about some of the warning signs that we saw in financials, and you know, that episode's aired by now, so go back and take a listen to that. But one of the warning signs that we often see are round numbers, right?
Oh, yeah.
round numbers are, yeah, these are not clean financials. These are estimates.
Yeah. Unless it's a payroll, but if you've got expenses of advertising of $1,500 a month or your phone bills, you know, $2,300 a month. Yeah, the round numbers are always challenging. But clean financials are so important because it allows us to look at things from an analytical eye and from the buyer's eye. And you yourself, you say you look at trends. Which trends specifically do you hone in on?
Well, the number one trend I like to look at would be year over year trends. All right. So there's, when we're looking at trends, just as in general for a business, there's two main approaches that people take. One would be a month over month. So are we doing better this month than we did the month before? And was that month better than the month before that? And how does that look? And maybe you spread that out and do like a quarter over quarter analysis. I like to take a look at businesses more from a year over year analysis. So if I'm taking a look at July of 2018, I want to compare that against July of 2017. Or if I'm going to do it on a, like a quarterly basis, I might take a look at quarter two of this year and compare it to quarter two of the year before and of the year before that. And the reason that I do this is I think people have seasonal businesses without knowing that they have a seasonal business. Obviously, like Halloween, you know, I've sold a number of Halloween sites in the past. That's an obvious seasonal business. Christmas, obvious seasonal business. Gardening supply store, a little less obvious, but when you think about it, yeah, it's a seasonal business. I think those aren't too far of stretches. But when you take a look at a company like Quiet Light Brokerage, we also have seasons, right? We have our busy seasons. We have our a little bit less busy seasons. Summers tend to slow down a little bit. It's not appreciable. It's not like one of those things where you can look at it and say, it's going to be absolutely dead. And I wouldn't call us having a seasonal business, but in the books, it does get reflected that way. So I like the year-over-year financial analysis because it controls some of those variables and also some of the variables for having a few extra days in a month or a few less days in a month.
Yeah, I think you've got to specifically look at that, you know, month-over-month analysis because of the seasonality. You know, someone will say, well, is there the best time to sell my business? And it's really the time that's right for that particular individual. But when you're comparing December of 2018 to December of 2017, that is what is most relevant. It's not necessarily all of 2018 against all of 2017. Because if you just look at the annual numbers of 17 versus 18, it's only going to paint a partial picture. We're always looking for monthly trends beyond that. We look at that bigger picture, and that's what we can talk about, that big picture in the teaser where people are going to see the listing for the first time, you know, 60% year-over-year growth or whatever the number might be. But you've got to drill down into that month over month. You know, how does December, I guess it's year over year, December of 18 look to December of 17? Because you could have had a great, you know, first three quarters, and then the fourth quarter of 2018, it could have, you know, fallen off a cliff. It still may look like 60% growth year over year, but the most recent quarter could be down dramatically, and that dramatically reduces the value of the business because of the risk going forward.
And the other thing that I found, and I wrote a blog post on this several years ago, we'll link to it in the show notes. And if you and I were professional podcasters, I would have done like actual show prep and been able to have this example at my fingertips. But I did this blog post years ago on how to perform a year-over-year financial analysis. And then I put together some dummy data. And this actually kind of randomly happened when I put it together, where from a month-over-month standpoint, the business looked like it was growing and growing at a good clip. But when you took a look at it at a year-over-year financial analysis, what you're able to see is that the growth was slowing dramatically on the business. And that was extremely valuable in that, again, just kind of pretend scenario, to be able to see you know, the actual trend. Where is the direction of this business going? The other thing that I want to point out about this, and you know, I don't want to spend an inordinate amount of time on this specific topic of year-over-year financial analysis, but I think the one thing that we need to kind of pull back on with online businesses is we tend to really take a microscopic view of the financials. We'll often take a look at just the past couple months and consider that to be a trend. Starting to broaden out our time frames, I think, is a good thing to do, especially from a buying standpoint and understanding what is the context of the earnings of this business. When I started Quiet Light Brokerage in 2006, 2007, you know, most companies were just a few years old. Now we're seeing businesses that are 20, 25 years old on the long end. And so we have more history to work with. And I just think year over year is a better solution for that. So that's my number one thing that I look for.
I agree. And I'm going to drill down beyond that and the next thing that I would look at. But, you know, not being professional podcasters shows that we're human, which is exactly what we are. Okay, that's too much ego there. Sorry, folks. What I do when you talk about a particular blog and we're not prepared for it, all you got to do is Google Quiet Light Brokerage and year-over-year analysis, and boom, there it is. So for the record, you've done a great job over the last decade. Beyond the, you know, year-over-year comparison, month-over-month comparison, what I drill down into next is revenue by channel, right? Because a buyer is going to look at it and, you know, see what's happening in the most recent, you know, 3 months compared to the same 3 months last year or year-to-date, things of that nature. That shows the trends of the business and which way it's going. Beyond that, what I like to drill down to, and this goes to documentation, is revenue by channel. So you know, is it, let's say it's a physical products business. Am I getting, you know, 60% of my revenue from Amazon, 25% B2B, and 15% from a new Shopify store? And then beyond that, what are the trends within those channels? For instance, I had a listing a while back where it was 100% Amazon, and they, like most, started out on Amazon.com and then expanded to Germany, UK, Canada, Japan, Italy, and those countries took off and were really growing. At the same time, the US started to trend down. So they put all of their efforts into the new countries and stopped putting efforts into the country that was generating the most revenue. Overall, if you looked at month over month numbers as a whole, we were still up. Year over year, we were still up. But there was a concerning trend within all of it, and that was that the biggest revenue generator was dropping, and then it was being replaced with other channels. So overall, I guess if you just look at the broad picture, it was okay. But when you want to drill down into those things to get a really clearer picture of it, and that goes for you know, Shopify channels or e-com, your own URL, whether it's WooCommerce, Shopify, whatever it might be, and then the B2B side too. These are if you're selling physical products. Same goes for content sites or SaaS sites, whatever they might be, advertising sites or SaaS sites. If you've got different methods of advertising and revenues, whether it's, you know, straight up sales from your website or affiliate revenue, you want to break that out in your financials so that you can see them, so you can see what you're doing right and what you're doing wrong, but also so your broker advisor, exit planner, and your buyer can see it as well. Because you may have some great things in there. You know, if you started a Shopify store 9 months ago and it's already at 15% of your total revenue, it's only 9 months out of the trailing 12. So you've got built-in growth there, and that is a really exciting thing for buyers.
Yeah, I dealt with a client recently where we were having a little bit of trouble moving his business because it was on the decline, right? And he had a lot of revenue, but there was a couple of problems with the business where it was sick in a few ways. And what I found is out of our buyers, and we had lots of inquiries on this business because we put it up at a pretty low multiple, most buyers backed out right away. When they saw the trends, they just kind of backed out, said, nah, I'm not really all that interested in this business. I don't want to turn around, what have you. The buyers that we've grown to know over the years that are really successful at what they're doing, they took a little bit more time. And the first thing that they started to do is exactly what you're talking about. They started to take those financials and some of those summation numbers that we see in financials, and they started to break them apart. They started to really dig into those numbers and see, okay, what makes up this revenue? And when we start to break these apart, what can we find in here? What's sick and what's healthy? And is what's healthy sustainable? And is what's sick, is that fixable? Or is that something that we can just get rid of? And so they started looking at that on a per channel basis, but they also started looking at it on a per SKU basis as well and running an analysis. And one of the things that we found with this is that you could actually lighten up the workload of this business and actually increase profitability significantly by removing a large number of the SKUs because they were not all that profitable. Now, again, that's not necessarily the multi-channel analysis that you're talking about, but I think this general principle of when you're looking at revenue, especially with an e-commerce business that can have multiple channels of revenue, don't just take the summation number, start to break it apart. And from the sell side, if you're selling, don't be afraid of reporting those numbers either. There's opportunity in those numbers that you can show potential buyers. And, you know, I think a little dose of humility for all of us goes a long way. Sometimes somebody's going to come in and take a look at your business and be able to have an observation that maybe we've been missing for a while. And from a selling standpoint, that's your opportunity. If a buyer comes in and notices something that you missed, and so give them that data, give them the opportunity to make that sort of observation. I think that's a good thing for people to look for. Is there any channel, in your opinion, that you like better than others or that you look at and you would weight as more valuable than others?
Oh, yeah. I mean, any channel where you own the customer. You know, if it's just your own website where you're owning the customer completely and you can remarket to them and upsell them and reach out to them socially via email, whatever method you can. But absolutely owning the customer brings more value than, you know, an Amazon platform, for instance. Amazon's growing like crazy, so don't discount it if you're selling physical products. You have to be there, in my opinion. You're missing out on, you know, a tremendous amount of revenue if you're not there. But owning the customers, the most important thing in terms of overall value. One of the things I want to jump to, Mark, is it's on our list here to talk about in terms of, you know, the year-over-year analysis and drilling down and getting below that total revenue line to either gross profit as a percentage of total revenue or discretionary earnings as a percentage of total revenue. Which one do you look at first?
I look at gross profit first if it's an e-commerce business, and just because that's a simpler number to digest, right? There's only really one thing that's getting thrown into that gross profit number. You've got your revenue, you've got your landed cost of goods sold, and that's pretty much it, right? That's going into the gross profit number. So it's an easier thing to really understand, and really at the core of an e-commerce business is that, you know, what is the cost of your product and what are people willing to pay for it right now? And how is that trending? And I think with e-commerce businesses specifically, because price competition is a real thing with e-commerce businesses in most niches, you have to really pay attention to how is the profitability of this industry holding up over time? Is it becoming more competitive? Is the competition happening on a price front? Or are suppliers becoming more aggressive in their pricing as well? So that's one of the first things that I look at when I start to really dig into those financials. I want to see how is that gross profit margin holding up over time? Is it getting more expensive to do this business or is it holding up?
You know, it's funny. I think I agree with you that what you should have in your expenses above the gross profit line are your cost of goods sold, your landed cost of goods sold. But I often see them in from bookkeepers, and they include, in some cases, fees associated with third-party platforms. I don't know if there's a right way or a wrong way, but you got to dissect that a little bit when doing the analysis. Is there a particular percentage of profit that you look at and you're like, no, your cost of goods sold are just simply too high. The margins are too tight. This is going to be a real hard one to sell. You ever run across any of those?
I do, and I'll get to that in just a second. I'm going to chide all the bookkeepers out there that are including fees in there as cost of goods sold. The technical definition for a cost of goods sold has to be involved in the actual production and sourcing of the product itself, the transactional costs. So if you're keeping your books that way, it's a minor issue and a quarreling issue that I won't fight too hard, but it's supposed to go in the regular operational expenses instead.
I fell asleep in accounting class. I just focus on what I focus on. I told you this story before. We work with Scott at Catching Clouds, Matt at CapForge. Fully Accountable is a recent one that's come across my desk, and all three seem to do a really solid job. And having a great bookkeeper brings a windfall of cash when you go to list your business for sale.
Oh, absolutely. And you know what? One of those guys might disagree with me, and then we can whip out our pocket protectors and have a pen fight over that.
Right. But yeah, let's keep the people awake. We don't want to talk about that.
All right, move on. So percentages, absolutely. You know, you want to see a healthy gross profit percentage. I talked to one buyer, and I won't say her name because I don't know if she wants me saying this, but she told me that she wouldn't look at a business that had less than 50% gross profit margins. Now, I wouldn't go that far. In my opinion, when I'm looking at a business from a broker standpoint, I start to get nervous when gross profit margins dip below 20% is when I get nervous. 25% and lower, I'm a little uncomfortable with that, but you know, I think that's doable. I think the average that I see would be right around 35%. 30 to 35% would be the average. Obviously, the higher you can have, the better. There are certain industries, electronics being one of them, that tend to just have really low gross profit margins. And you know, the problem with that, I mean, if just think about it on a basic basis, if you have a 10% gross profit margin, which for a lot of electronics, that's where you're at. You're looking at having to have $1 million in revenue to be able to generate $100,000 in just gross profit. That's a lot of money that you have to generate in order to get some gross profit. So
yeah, my rule is about 20%. Doesn't count your advertising, doesn't count your payroll or anything like that. So
or your transactional fees exactly. On the marketplace.
Exactly, as they should be down below that gross profit
as they should.
Line. So let's work down that P&L. You know, you've got total revenue, you've got gross profit, and then you've got all these expenses in there. One of the things that I always look pretty closely at, if I have the detail up above, is the advertising channel. Do you ever get to see advertising expenses by channel in a P&L?
By channel, I'm trying to think if I've seen it. With Amazon, you'll see it. Sometimes you'll see Amazon advertising expenses broken out separate from.
Wouldn't it be amazing to see it though? Just for those bookkeepers out there and those people that are doing it themselves.
Oh my gosh.
If you've got revenue by channel up above, you know, the total revenue line, why not have advertising by channel down below? You can do it in QuickBooks in Xero. You just got to have a subset of it. In the exported P&L, it may say just total advertising, but you can show that separately. And the reason I love to look at that is because it can show too heavy of a weight in one particular channel, again, in the advertising dollars. This is airing in, you know, August of 2018. As many people listening know, there was an algorithm update in Facebook in April, and a lot of people got hurt by that. And if they were overspending on Facebook advertising, and they might have found themselves too heavily weighted on one channel, and that advertising didn't work as well anymore, and their revenues might have dropped, or they had to pick up the ball somewhere else, and it took a while. So it goes to that detail. The more detail we can see, the more we'll understand those trends, and a buyer can make a more informed decision. If somebody's stroking a check for $100,000, $500,000, $1 million, whatever the number is, they've worked hard for that money, they've saved it, they're smart, they're intelligent, they're going to get to those numbers eventually, and it's better to do it upfront in advance so that once you're under letter of intent, you get all the way through to closing. So I'm always trying to drill down into those details. So I would love advertising by channel. I don't always get it, but it's a question that I'm always asking. And is that spending by channel going up or down? I think if you can, again, diversify by channel, and if it's Facebook, if it's Instagram, if it's AdWords, if it's inside your sponsored account or whatever it might be, if you're selling SaaS products, affiliate, whatever you might be doing, having that level of detail is truly ideal. And I'm always looking for it if I can get it. I can't often get it out of just the P&L, but generally there's enough detail in the back end for the client, the person owning the business, to be able to share that.
Yeah, I've used an analogy sometime. And by the way, real quick, just kind of a public service announcement here. If anybody is listening to this in your car, it's late at night, you've been driving for a while, put this on pause, go put on like a really exciting song for a little bit, and then come back and finish it. No, all right. So
This is all huge.
It should be exciting.
You and I do this all the time. And it's exciting for a client when we go through these numbers and we find something, and all of a sudden they realize that if we do this right, their business, they don't have to generate any more revenue, but their business, when properly presented, is worth $250,000 more. So that's pretty exciting. You don't have to generate more revenue.
Well, absolutely. So I'm actually going to bring this to botany, of all things. I think it's botany. I'm probably not. But the study of trees, right? In tree rings. Yeah, you're looking at me like I'm crazy.
Yeah, well, you are. Okay.
Yeah, well, I am a little bit crazy. But one of the cool things that I learned years ago about tree rings, you know, when you slice a tree and you can see all the rings and stuff like that, scientists are able to tell all sorts of information from those rings, right? They're able to tell if there was a fire at a certain time in that area, or if it was a drought year, or if it was heavy rains that year, and the average temperature as well. You can find all sorts of information like that. And the reason I bring this up, there is a point here, besides me just talking about the fun things I learned on the side outside of work, is that financials, I look at financials in sort of the same way. It's the record of the business, and it's quantified what's happening to your business in other ways, right? Facebook's algorithm change, it's an actual change in your customer acquisition strategy, and it shows up on those books. There's very little that happens in your business that's not going to show up somewhere in your financial records. And so when you keep detailed financial records, what you're doing is you're keeping the story of your business in a quantified way. And for buyers who are trying to evaluate a business, you know, buyers look at this from all sorts of different ways, especially experienced buyers. They're going to look at your business from an ROI standpoint. They want to understand, you know, can I make money from this? But they're also going to look at it from the story of the business and try and get in the head, you as the business owner, and what it's been like to run it for the past number of X years. And so your point about keeping more detailed records and breaking advertising down into channels, your AdWords, your Facebook, if you've messed around with Pinterest for a while, if you've done some Quora advertising, what have you, that's part of the story of your business that you can tell when you really start to break down financials historically.
Yeah, and I think it's important to understand that all of those details are important to be able to share. Somebody listening that's, you know, planning on selling their business, they may want to say, I don't want to share those negative trends. I don't want to talk about that fire that I had back in June of 2017. it's going to come out. So you might as well, you know, get those details out there and ready and available for your buyers, because trust, when you lay it all out there, it builds trust. And trust is important because it offsets risk a little bit. And again, when you offset that risk, a buyer's willing to pay more for your business. And it's all important. It goes into your social media accounts too. You know, I've had, and I won't go on a tangent, but, and I won't name names, but I've had clients that I'm selling their business and I pop into the social media account and their profile picture is them on the beach topless with a beer in their hand and chugging whatever. Those are men topless, by the way. And I'm like, it's great, but you know, just put a shirt on for a little while. Just change the profile picture because we're trying to build trust and respect in who you are. Buyers want to buy from, you know, clients, sellers that they like and that they trust more than anything else. So that's why you want to share all those, you know, rings of the tree and tell the full story. Because they'll look at the mistakes that you've made and the expertise that they have that you don't and go, opportunity. I have capital to not run out of inventory and you did. I'm smarter than you are, or I have more money than you are. That's really, really critical stuff to have.
Anyway, well, with the negative trends in the past, by the way, I just want to say one quick thing. It's not a bad thing if you have a negative trend in the past. In fact, I like it when I see a business that has had a decline and recovered. I can go to a buyer and say, look how resilient this business is. Exactly. They ran out of product for 2 months and they're still, you know, chugging along great. It didn't kill them.
That's right. I actually had a situation where a client had a patent infringement claim filed against them, and not just against that particular client, but against everybody that was selling a similar product. And it turns out that everyone else stopped selling that product, period. My client hired an attorney, fought the infringement, won, and ended up being one of the only sellers of that particular product anymore. And that just, the revenues shot up, gained more market share. And it's a ugly thing, a patent infringement. You don't want to talk about that, right? No, you absolutely do, because odds of it happening again, incredibly low. And in this situation, you know, it turned out to be very positive as well. So I say expose all the rings of the tree in your analogy in botany. Let us know if botany is not, I think it is the right phrase, but anyway.
I think it's like the big family. I think there's probably a more narrow specialty.
We could be looking at it. We are sitting in front of computers. You want to drill down a little further? We've talked about advertising by channel. What would you look at next in a, let's say, a financial presentation, a profit loss statement?
Well, I'm going to start getting into the specific expenses, and I want to take a look at what the individual expenses are to see, are any trending higher? Basically, is this business getting more difficult to run? Is it getting more expensive to run? And the other thing that you can see from just kind of an expense profile would be attempts at growth. You often see expenses ramp up when people expect growth. So you can get the sense for where the business is arcing from taking a look at individual expenses. So I would look at staffing costs. Have they really ramped up? Are you seeing a lot of professional legal fees ramp up? That would be something that you want to dig into and try and get a little bit of explanation into. But really try and get in, again, to some of those individual expenses and see spikes and anomalies, you know, things that kind of stand out, because those, again, are going to be the big stories that you want to get into later on. So we move a little bit away from trend analysis when we start looking at that, and we start getting into just a, kind of that anomaly analysis of a financial statement to see, you know, what questions do we need to be asking on this particular business?
Yeah, and it's not just anomalies where there's spikes in revenue, but sometimes expenses disappear. And when they disappear for the last 2 or 3 months of the trailing 12, and now they want to sell their business, they're just, either they made a mistake and just forgot to put it in, but they're just cutting costs to increase their discretionary earnings. So we drill down into all of that. Every buyer will. We do it for them, ask those questions and get it exposed so that, you know, it's a good investment for a buyer and the seller achieves their goals as well.
Something I want to ask you about, Joe, we get talked a lot, Quiet Light in general gets pegged a lot as kind of like the e-commerce broker. Like that's what we do. But we actually sell a lot of SaaS businesses.
And content or advertising businesses. If you look at the revenue on closed transactions year to date, there's an awful lot of SaaS and an awful lot of content in there as well.
Right. I explain to people it's actually not a majority of e-commerce. It's a plurality for us. So we're less than 50% of our deals are e-commerce. It's somewhere around 40, 45%. So I want to get into subscription-based revenue. And how do you look at that when you're evaluating a business? What do you, you've done a number of SaaS businesses or sold a number of SaaS businesses. How do you evaluate subscription-based revenue?
Yeah, anytime someone's looking at subscription-based businesses to buy, you know, the eye that they look at it with is, what does it cost to acquire that customer, and what is the lifetime value of that customer? Okay, they have different terminologies for it, churn rate, and so on and so forth. You know, how if you get a gain of, if you gain 100 new customers, how many are churning every month? Meaning how many go away. You want to keep that very low. We're always looking at that churn rate. But the simple way to look at it is from a buyer's perspective. If you've, you know, I just closed a transaction. It was a software as a service business around for 14 years. And it was created originally as a solution to a developer's problem. The developer created it. And then it just sort of grew organically. And 14 years later, he had a very successful business, but he didn't have any data. He was only spending about literally like $300 a month on advertising. Like, okay, well, what is the cost to acquire that customer with your advertising? And then how long does that customer stick around? What is their lifetime value? So that a buyer wants to look at it and go, okay, it costs you $100 to acquire a customer, but the lifetime value of that customer is $400. My margins are really strong. That means, okay, I can spend more money on advertising dollars and I can double the revenue of this company. They're always looking at that aspect of it from, you know, a subscription-based business. And that could be physical products or software as a service. That churn rate's really, really important. Lifetime value, repeat customer. Once you gain a customer, in if you've got the ability to offer them additional products and upsells, that's something that I'm always looking for if you've got that model where you can add to it. The percentage of repeat customers, that monthly recurring revenue, always looking at those numbers. I mean, just saying that there's monthly recurring revenue of $60,000 right away, you just do the math on that. It's $360,000 of revenue that you're not putting advertising dollars to because it's already recurring and there's a fixed margin there. That stuff is really exciting. And if you're an owner of a software service business or a subscription-based model, you know, box business, you've got to have those numbers because that's what buyers are going to look for. They're going to want to know, how much does it cost? Because I'm bringing a whole lot of working capital. I'm going to blow this thing up. And they want to know the cost to acquire that customer, lifetime value. Two most important things, in my opinion.
Did we run out of things?
We got a couple more.
We have a couple more.
Drill down to the bottom. Discretionary earnings. We know, hopefully everybody knows, discretionary earnings is your net income plus your ad backs. Net income at the bottom of profit loss statement. Ad backs are the personal expenses you run through the business that are your own benefits and one-time expenses. So you got net income plus ad backs equals seller's discretionary earnings. Where do you feel most comfortable? Where do you see buyers feel most comfortable in terms of that discretionary earnings as a percentage of your total revenue?
Boy, that's a great question. And I think it depends a little bit on the business itself, right? So SaaS companies tend to have higher SDE to revenue percentages. Content sites can have, depending on how they're set up, can also have higher percentages. E-commerce tend to have a little bit lower percentages relative to revenue. So, I'm not sure if I've looked at this in terms of percentages as far as SDE to percentage. I would assume since you asked the question that you have.
I have. And, 10%, you got to have at least, I think. I can tell you what I don't want, and I've turned away businesses that I just simply won't list them because they're not going to sell, are those that have 1 or 2%. You know, look, I'm not talking they're doing 3 million in discretionary earnings, you know, off of 30 million in revenue. That's a saleable business, no question about it. But when you're doing, 1 or 2% of your total margins, you're spending a lot of money on advertising dollars, you're carrying a lot of working capital and inventory, you make a mistake, 0.5% one way or the other, and your profit drops dramatically. And anytime I've looked at those, anytime we've listed things that, you know, have a smaller percentage margin there in discretionary earnings, buyers get really nervous and they look at it from that point of view. So you've really got to do that math and not go, oh yeah, it's 200,000 in discretionary earnings. You got to go, okay, it's 200,000. And what percentage is that of my total revenue? And how do I improve that? And then you drill down to those expenses. Dave Bryant, who's part of the e-commerce podcast, e-com crew, right? Which Michael Jackness, he was our client. And a year before we sold his business, he did that. He looked at that bottom line seller's discretionary earnings as a percentage of the total revenue, and then drilled down into certain SKUs and looked at the profit margin of those and either renegotiated the ones that were not profitable enough or got rid of a few and added about 40,000 in discretionary earnings to his business and about $120,000 to the list price of the business. So you want to get it, I'd say shoot for 10%. 5% gets a little, depending upon the business and how large total revenues are, but it's always a case-by-case basis. So anytime you get down to that 2-3% range, I get really, really nervous, as do buyers.
I do think that part of it is revenue dependent, right? I've found with businesses that have kind of eye-popping revenue numbers that even if the discretionary earnings is a very small percentage, as you point out, if a business is doing $30 million in revenue per year and has really low percentage of discretionary earnings, it's still a sellable business because you've got $30 million of revenue per year to be able to play with. It's when you get in those territories of, say, you have $500,000 of revenue and your discretionary earnings is just 10% of that, so $50,000, that's not a lot of room for error before you're in negative territory and you don't have a lot of extra room and capital to be able to really pour into the growth of that business. So I think that's a good thing to be able to look at. I think a lot of it depends on the size of the business.
Yeah, completely agree. We didn't start, we didn't time this podcast. So I have no idea how long we've been chatting for, but I want to touch on one more thing that is really important, I think, for buyers to look at in terms of opportunity and for sellers to track in terms of, opportunity to get more value for your business. Buyers, in terms of if they're not detailing it and you can figure it out, you'll see built-in growth. And that is revenue by SKU. And that is whether it's a physical products business or, a subscription business, again, box or software as a service, because sometimes software as a service, they offer different packages and whatnot. If you've launched a SKU, a new product in the last 12 months, and I've seen this before, and let's say you've got a dozen SKUs and six of them are only, they're under 9 months old and staggered within there, you've got built-in growth. And so what I like to drill down to, if I can get it, is revenue by SKU for the trailing 12 months. Because if a SKU was launched 6 months ago, but it's already up to 18% of the total revenue, that's huge because you've got six more months and it's growing. It's absolute built-in growth and it brings more value for a buyer. You can push the value of the business a little bit higher. And if you can share that detail with the buyers, they're gonna get it. They're gonna look at it and go, yes, I get it, I understand. Classic example of that is Kent Runner. We had him here on the podcast early on back in December, right? 300% year over year growth. And he only owned the business for 6 months. The business had a total of 16 SKUs when he bought it. 9 of them had been launched within the trailing 12 months and represented about 40% of the total revenues. So it's absolute built-in growth. And Kent took that business and it was doing $1 million in revenue when he bought it to $3 million in total revenue inside of a total of 12 months. And that was because of that revenue by SKU detail that Evan, the seller, was able to provide and sort of built in paths to growth for Kent's takeover.
Yeah, so I'm going to make a point here, and this might be getting way too into the weeds on this topic here, but I'm going to just venture in there anyways. And just as an advanced tactic for buyers to look at, I think what you're saying there is absolute gold. And again, I've seen some of our top buyers do just that. They really get into the SKUs and they start to take a look at it. So let's get into a situational analysis here and say you have an e-commerce business that recently launched some SKUs within the past year or 2 years. And I'm saying this because I have this case with a client. They're keeping their books on a cash basis. From a buying opportunity, in my opinion, this is like absolute gold because their costs relative to their revenue is going to be very, very high. They're building up inventory in a product that is growing in sales but isn't really there yet. And so you have super depressed, depressed or understated gross profit, which is going to pop very soon. This is like one of those signals that you're like, buy. Like if you know what you're looking at, buy this thing because it's going to pop in the next year and you're going to see that massive growth. Again, yeah, might be too much in the weeds there.
Getting into cash versus accrual accounting with cost of goods sold, way into the weeds. But I'm telling you right now, as a buying opportunity, if you're looking at other brokerage firms, which hopefully you're looking at everybody, an inexperienced broker is going to take a listing and go, yeah, okay, there's the discretionary earnings. We'll do a few add backs and here's the multiple on that discretionary earnings. An experienced broker is going to take that same profit loss statement, a physical products business, and make sure that the cost of goods sold is presented on an accrual basis. That discretionary earnings number, most often with a business that's growing rapidly, where you're taking excess working capital, putting it back into inventory, that discretionary earnings is going to pop. And I've seen $250,000 increase in the value of a business because of it. Let me see if I can do some simple math. Imagine you have in the trailing cost, trailing 12 months, a cost of goods sold of $1 million on a cash basis. It's a big number, but I'm trying to do round numbers. And let's say that on a cash basis, you're overinflated by 5%. If you flipped it to accrual, instead of having 35% cost of goods sold, your real cost of goods sold is only 30%, but because your cash, you're 5% higher. 5% times that $1 million that you've got there on the books is $50,000. If your business is worth three times, that's $150,000 added on to the list price of the business. Or if you're a buyer and it's not presented that way, it's $150,000 of instant equity when you're buying that business.
All right. So for those of you listening, you now need to fact check us on whether or not botany is the right field of science. And also if Joe's math is correct on that, because I don't know if it is, but we'll go with it. And the point is there, I think the general rule of thumb that we follow here is a growing business that's kept on a cash basis is going to understate their discretionary earnings and their gross profit, generally speaking. And a business in decline that is on cash basis generally overstates their discretionary earnings if they're not putting inventory money back into inventory at that point. So those are the basic rules of thumb. Keep in mind, there's exceptions there always. I think this has been a long podcast right now. We have not been timing it. We're probably around the 45-minute mark.
Hopefully you guys are still awake. If there's any questions that came up during the podcast, shoot us an email. Inquiries at Quiet Light Brokerage, Mark at Quiet Light Brokerage, Joe at Quiet Light Brokerage. Anybody's first name, for the most part, at quietlightbrokerage.com.
That's right. And this format of an episode, normally, of course, we like to bring on guests and the friends of Quiet Light Brokerage onto the show. And we have more of those coming up here in the near future. We got some pretty good guests coming up. But we wanted to start sprinkling in some of these episodes where it's just Joe and I talking, or maybe we'll talk with somebody else within the company, not to really give a background on them, but to give insights or some of the ways that we attack some of the issues that come up when buying or selling an online business. Give us feedback on this, please. We'd love to hear it. You can send an email, like Joe said, to Mark at Quiet Light Brokerage or Joe at Quiet Light Brokerage. Or if you don't want us to know and you just want to complain about us, send it over to Jason at quietlightbrokerage.com. And, you know, he's good at keeping secrets. So you can complain to him.
Sounds good. Thanks, Mark. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Quiet Light Podcast. For more resources from this episode, head over to quietlightbrokerage.com. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a rating and review in iTunes. This helps share the messages from the show with more business owners like you.